is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You may have heard that the United States Supreme Court has handed down a big decision this week, and it has to do with the right of the government to take your property. It's called the right of eminent domain. It is a power that up until now has been significantly limited in terms of the ability of local and state governments to take your property. It has to be for what is defined as a public purpose, but according to the United States Supreme Court just this week, that public purpose can include economic development. That may sound like a remote issue to you, but it won't be a remote or abstract issue if it's your house, your property, or your church facility that's on the line. We'll be talking about that, and you need to know about this. And your church, your Christian circle of friends, your neighbors, you need to be knowledgeable about this. You need to be talking about it. You need to be aware that what happens in Washington, the United States Supreme Court, especially on a case like this, can very, very quickly filter down to where we all live. I want to talk to you today about the limits of encouragement. We all want to be encouraging. We know that the ministry of encouragement is a very important biblical issue. After all, Barnabas in Acts 4, verse 36, is named Barnabas, his previous name was Joseph, precisely because the apostles wanted to name him as a son of encouragement. But I want us to recognize that encouragement has its limits. Encouragement requires a moral and a theological context. In other words, we need to encourage the right things. Encouraging persons to do the wrong things, to hold the wrong beliefs, to take the wrong actions, is certainly the wrong form of encouragement. That's what came to my mind when I was thinking about Joel Osteen's appearance on Larry King Live just this past week. Now, I am reluctant to even talk about this. I did not want to particularly raise Mr. Osteen for criticism, but I want you to know that this is an issue that I think demands a clear, convictional Christian response. Mr. Osteen is pastor of what is recognized and called America's largest church, over 30,000 people a week at the Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. He is also the author of a best-selling book entitled Your Best Life Now. And on June the 20th, he was on Larry King Live to talk about his book and his ministry and all the rest. Mr. King asked him about fire and brimstone, that is, heaven and hell. Mr. Osteen replied, "No, that's not me. It's never been me. I've always been an encourager at heart. And when I took over from my father, he came from the Southern Baptist background. And back 40, 50 years ago, there's a lot more of that. But, you know, I just don't believe in that. I don't believe, maybe it was for a time, but I don't have it in my heart to condemn people. I'm there to encourage them. I see myself more as a coach, as a motivator, to help them experience the life God has for us." Well, that sounds pretty problematic, pretty thin to me, but it gets worse. He goes on and says, "You may not agree with me, but to me it's not my job to try to straighten everybody out. The gospel is called the good news. My message is a message of hope. That's God's for you. You can live a good life no matter what happened to you, and so I don't know. I know there is condemnation, but I don't feel that's my place." Well, it would be nice, in one sense, to be able to have a ministry in which you never have to condemn anything, in which you never have to say that any idea is wrong, and you never have to condemn any particular practice as sinful. That would be very culturally advantageous. It would lead to a much smoother set of relationships. It would make the Christian ministry much less confrontational than it is. And all of us would have to admit we would, at least at some moments, like it that way. But that's not the way it is. The demands of truth simply will not go away. Mr. Osteen says he believes in heaven and hell, but it's not clear how anyone in his theology would ever get to hell. He even left the door open for atheists to go to heaven. He said to Mr. King, "You know what? I'm going to let God be the judge of who goes to heaven and hell. I present the truth, and I say it every week. You know, I believe it's a relationship with Jesus. But you know what? I'm not going to go around telling everybody else if they don't want to believe that that's going to be their choice. God's got to look at your own heart. God's got to look at your heart, and only God knows that." Now, insofar as I can make sense out of that statement, it appears to say that atheists may be in heaven, because he's talking about atheists in particular. When he was talking about sin, or whether he calls people sinners, he said, Mr. King actually asked the question, "Is that a word you don't use, that is sinner?" Mr. Osteen answered, "I don't use it. I never thought about it, but I probably don't. But most people already know what they're doing wrong." When I get them to church, I want to tell them that you can change. There can be a difference in your life. So I don't go down the road of condemning. End quote. Well, I'm really lost here. In other words, why should someone change if what they're doing isn't identified as sin? I mean, why should you change if it's not wrong? And how are people going to know what's right and what's wrong if the pastor of the church sees it as his responsibility merely to encourage people with a smile? I have no doubt that Mr. Osteen wants to help people. I have no doubt that he has the highest motivations in his own heart, that he wants to encourage people. But there's an even higher motivation than that, and that is to tell people the truth, because only the truth can save. In the book of 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul speaks of the aroma that leads from death to death and the aroma that leads from life to life. There are messages that sound good, but they lead from death to death. Something short of the gospel leads not to life, but to death. The transforming power of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, that's what leads to life. It does so by telling us the truth. And that truth requires us, well, let's put it this way. We need to encourage people to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. We need to encourage people to trust in Christ alone. We need to encourage persons to repent of their sins. And we need to encourage persons to live to the glory of God. And that's going to require telling them what that looks like. And in the Bible, thanks be to God, we have God's self-revelation of what that looks like and what is incompatible with the Lordship of Jesus Christ. We need to encourage people, but encouraging people just for the sake of encouragement isn't real help. We have to encourage them according to the gospel. We have to encourage them to do and to believe the right things and to have the right aspirations. You know, there are an awful lot of books out there that are selling big. And there are churches out there that are attracting thousands and thousands of people, with millions more in spillover watching by television and through other ripple effects of the ministry. You just have to wonder, where is the real ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ there? We have to look for the gospel. We have to be unapologetic in saying our task is to find the gospel in this content. And if it's not there, to be honest about the fact, to be honest that it's simply not there. Shifting gears, we've been talking about the population issues because this, too, is an issue of Christian responsibility, and the Christian worldview has a unique vantage point from which to look at these declining birth rates, not only in the United States, which is barely at a replacement level, but also in Europe, which is below a replacement level. But the one nation that has the worst replacement level, that is, the birth rate that falls the shortest of the replacement rate, is Japan, and it is now reaching a crisis there. The government recognizes it's a crisis, but you know, this is not the kind of crisis you can fix overnight. You can't create 20-year-olds. Even if there is a massive change in the Japanese culture right now that leads to a vast increase in birth rates, and that is not on the horizon. Even that, in terms of workers that would be contributing to the economy, is two decades out at the very least. Folks, God has a plan for us. God had a purpose in marriage. God has a purpose in human sexuality. God has a purpose in demonstrating His glory in procreation and in reproduction and in the birth of children and in the raising and care and nurture of children. And a society that turns its back on that, whether for economic or lifestyle reasons or whatever, is a society that sows the seeds of its own destruction. In Japan, they're primarily looking at this in terms of economics, because right now Japan has a national debt of 157% of its gross national product. You can't live that way. That is economically unsustainable. Japan also has more unfunded pension liabilities than its economy can come even close to handling. Japan already has a large cohort of elderly people who are at work. They have to work. Otherwise, the economy would fail and they wouldn't eat. Of course, the answer to this right now, the short-term answer of the government, is to put more women to work. Do they not recognize that that's incompatible with turning around the nation's disastrously declined birth rate? Where's the common sense in all of this? That's a key question for us. We need to remember that we as Christians are not trying to figure these things out merely from the framework of secular reason. We're not just trying to let the economists and the sociologists and the demographers tell us the reality. We know that before we ever get to those questions, we serve a God who has revealed His purpose in the midst of creation. He has told us who we are, why He made us, and how He would have us to live. And He has told us from the very beginning of the Bible that the institution of marriage is paramount. And one of the non-negotiable purposes of marriage is procreation and the raising of children. You know, some of the most embarrassed people on earth must be all of those theorists and ideologues who back in the 1960s and 70s were warning about a population explosion. Right now, the great danger is a population implosion. A few years from now, who's going to be doing the working? Who's going to be paying the taxes? Who's going to be taking care of an enormous wave of the elderly and the aged who won't be able to take care of themselves? The Bible says, as we sow, so shall we reap. And we can see that in demography. Demography is destiny, they say. We as Christians understand why. God has a purpose He's trying to tell us about, even in the midst of His creation. We'll be back to talk about this recent Supreme Court decision and why it matters. Live from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The Supreme Court handed down just this week a decision in the case Kelo versus City of New London, Connecticut. It's one of those that I think most Americans would probably just let pass. They hear about it on the news, see a headline in the newspaper, and think, well, that probably has nothing to do with me. Well, if that's what you think about this case, you'd be wrong. This has to do with the right of the government to take your property. It has to do with the interpretation of the takings clause of the Constitution. It has to do with the right of a government to simply seize your property by the power of eminent domain, legally defined, in order to serve some kind of public purpose. The particular issue here in Connecticut was a group of residents who did not want to lose their homes when this city of New London, Connecticut, for the sake of economic development, decided they wanted to tear down their houses in order to build something that would bring in more taxes for the city, add more jobs, and all the rest. The Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, decided in favor of the city. And this sets an ominous precedent for all of us, because we're looking at the right of the government now to take your property. And in particular, we as Christians need to be aware that churches, in terms of church facilities, are particularly vulnerable in this regard. This case has come down in a way that has caught a lot of us by surprise, because there were a good many who believed that the court was going to go the other direction. It's just a reminder that you don't know how this court's going to act and how it's going to rule until you see the decision and hear it read. With us on the phone today is David Gobbets, who's Director of Litigation for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He is a member of the Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., and he is also the author of an amicus brief before the court on this case. Mr. Gobbets, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Great. It's a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Mohler. Minor thing, it's actually Derek, not David. But
excuse me. We had David here, but we're glad to know it's Derek. Derek, tell me, in the particular case we're talking about here, why should we be concerned?
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court has basically turned the taking clause on its head. I mean, it used to be, you know, you can only take things for a public purpose. What they've now said, you can take property from one private owner for another private owner, so long as you're promoting, you know, economic development, as you were explaining, generating tax revenues for the city. Religious institutions, churches, you know, religious schools, synagogues, mosques, I mean, everything, everybody's faces this risk, are in this country almost universally tax exempt, and they will be losers under this rule pretty much 100% of the time. I mean, if you want to generate more tax revenue and there's a church sitting there on the property and you'd like to give it to a use that will generate taxes for the city and for the coffers, you can take the church.
Mr. Gobbets, let me tell you, I wrote a piece just a few weeks ago, because the mayor of Pritchard, Alabama, asked his city council, this is in the Mobile, Alabama area, to adopt what he called a temporary moratorium on the construction of new church buildings. Because he said churches are using up all this property that could be going to tax-paying businesses that could be bringing in jobs and industry and all the rest. Now, isn't that what you and the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty are trying to watch out for?
Sure. I mean, and this is an unfortunately common problem, as I'm sure many of your listeners well know. And I mean, the takings aspect is sort of the most extreme, use of land use power by governments. But I mean, it often happens, you know, more insidiously, just through the way they draft normal zoning codes to either exclude churches entirely or to make them they can only locate in a jurisdiction if they, you know, jump through all the hoops of a conditional use permit, or maybe they set aside, you know, maybe kind of one area of the city that churches, you know, probably don't really want to be in, and, you know, aren't near their congregants. And so there's serious problems out there with the way cities are implementing their land use power. And this takings decision by the Supreme Court yesterday is unfortunately only going to encourage municipal authorities to take more liberties with the rights of churches.
Now, from a constitutional perspective, is this really an innovation? Writing in her dissent, Justice O'Connor seemed to think so. I'm reading here. She said, today the court abandons its long-held basic limitation on government power. Under the banner of economic development, all private property is now vulnerable to being taken and transferred to another private owner so long as it might be upgraded, that is, given to an owner who will use it in a way that the legislature deems more beneficial to the public in the process.
It is. I mean, she's accurate. I mean, you know, the decision didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, the Supreme Court had really, in some of its past decisions, including one by Justice O'Connor itself, it had kind of opened the door to this. And the hope was of us and some of the other parties involved in this case was that the Supreme Court would kind of see this, you know, giant loophole that had been created on what counted as a public purpose and would, you know, rein it in back to sort of the, you know, traditional public purposes that, you know, that you or I might think of you know, constructing a bridge or a dam or...
Well, I think that's what most people think of, you know, Mr. Gobbets, when it comes to eminent domain. They think of someone wanting to widen a road or to put in a new thoroughfare or a sewer system or a power plant, even something like that, that might be of urgent civic necessity. But it seems to me the new threat in this is that the government says, hey, you're not paying taxes on that property, Mr. Church. I can take that now and turn that into something very different. I can put a Walmart there, you know, or an upscale development there that will pay taxes. And in the amicus brief that your organization submitted to the court, you said this: religious institutions will always be targets for eminent domain actions under a scheme that disfavors nonprofit tax-exempt property owners and replaces them with for-profit, tax-generating businesses. Such a result is particularly ironic because religious institutions are generally exempted from taxes precisely because they are deemed to be beneficial and stabilizing influences in the community life. Well, that's what you wrote. That's what the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty argued before the court. So what does this decision now mean?
Well, this it means two things. Well, it means there's, you know, municipal authorities are going to feel emboldened to take more liberties than they have before. That's the first thing, and it means churches need to be prepared to fight them. There are some weapons left to do that. You know, what the court could have done yesterday is sort of given a wholesale solution to this. They could have reined in abuse of eminent domain power and kind of cabined the range of eminent domain back to its traditional uses, as you were saying, you know, things like sewers, roads, and stuff. They didn't do that. So what churches have to do now when confronted with a threatened use of eminent domain power to take their property is to raise the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, and another law called it's a mouthful, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It's called RLUIPA. And basically, what the Free Exercise Clause and RLUIPA do is they say that when the government is imposing a substantial burden on religious exercise, which, you know, taking its property would qualify as that, the government can only do that if they have a compelling interest and use the least restrictive means of doing so. So they need to go back to the First Amendment and sort of fight these cases, each one as they arise, and they should be prepared to do that.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been Derek Gobbets, who's Director of Litigation for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, and one of the firms, the organizations that on behalf of the causes we hold dear, filed an amicus brief with the United States Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the decision went the other way. That's what we've been talking about. Now we're going to talk about why it matters. Out there among the listeners to this program are many involved in churches and in other organizations, perhaps also in private property disputes, where the government has tried to exercise this right of eminent domain. Is it a threat to religious liberty? Give us a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It was the philosopher Thomas Hobbes who wrote the book Leviathan, warning that government will try to achieve absolute control. That's just the mechanism of how the sociology of government works. Writing back in the 16th century, he warned that government would try to reach into every aspect of life if it were not checked by certain limitations, boundaries, and balances. Well, I think we see in this Supreme Court decision handed down last week that the United States government has now awarded through its Supreme Court local governments and state governments a vastly increased power of eminent domain, which redefines the constitutional issue of the takings clause, the ability of government to come and seize your property. Now, let's be clear about a couple of things up front. First of all, it doesn't mean taking it without any kind of compensation. It's very clear that when government seizes property, they have to pay what somehow is determined as a fair market value for the property. You know, here in Louisville, Kentucky, where I am based and from which I'm speaking today, this power has been used, for example, to add runways at the airport where homes were taken, to make other civic improvements. All across America, when the interstate highway system was put in, this power was used enormously, because otherwise you would have had to have voluntarily the relinquishing of the property and the selling of the property that was required for all those thousands and thousands of miles of interstate. And in every community, this power has to be used from time to time just to put in utilities and all the rest. But this is different, because the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the government now has the right to take your property for the cause of economic development. Now, there is a very real socioeconomic issue here, and that is that those who are in impoverished communities face the danger that if the land underneath the home becomes valuable, the home can be seized, because the city can now say there is an economic reason for us to want to develop this, and we can move the residents out and move the business in. Or they can say we want to move this business out in order to move another business in. Or they can say, we can take this non-tax-paying church property and turn it into something that will provide revenue and jobs and all the rest. You can almost hear the arguments coming right now. I believe this is a significant threat to religious liberty and to individual liberty. And I think this is the kind of decision that will pass by the consciousness and the attention of a lot of Americans. But we need to talk about it here. I want to know what you think. Do you see this as a threat to religious liberty? And have you experienced anything like the kind of land issues that many churches are now facing, in which by zoning or by regulations or building codes or now the takings clause, churches are being denied the right and the freedom to build facilities for their ministries in strategic locations in America's cities and villages? Let's go to Chris calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Chris, go right ahead.
Dr. Mohler, I've been listening to you for a year now, and I have yet to agree with anything you've ever said, but you're absolutely right. This is the worst decision the Supreme Court ever handed down.
Well, wow. All of a sudden now we find something to agree on. Chris, I appreciate you calling. Spill this out a little bit for us. You know, what's your particular take on why this is so dangerous?
It's not just religious liberty, but really any nonprofit. You could talk about anybody that has a camp for kids, the YMCA, any group that is a nonprofit is a threat, and you could have individuals who are buying land for an investment. Maybe they think in a few years that land could increase in value and they could get a lot of money for it, and they don't want to sell it out. Or maybe a corporation comes in and says, I'll give you this amount of money for the land. You say, that's not enough money. I'm going to let it sit because I think I could make more of it, and this is my investment in my future. And that corporation, with its lobbying money, can go to local governments and say, force them to give it to me at this price because I don't want to wait for the price to go up.
Yeah, Chris, what you're describing there is exactly what has happened in some cities and suburban areas in California, where you can just Google or do a find law search and find that there are specific situations in which property, investment property, residential, business property has been seized, and it's been rezoned so that some preferred corporations and others can have access to that property, bring in developers, big box stores, and all the rest. And I think you're right. Chris, thanks for listening. I appreciate it. We found a common cause here, and I'm glad to hear from you. Folks, I want to know what you think. Give us the call, 877-893-8255 is the phone number. That's 877-893-TALK. Liberty is a precious commodity. It is one of those issues, one of those realities that must be protected both by decision and by definition. When you start changing the definitions in the Constitution and you start extending the government's increased power through what is known as the Takings Clause, pretty soon it can move from being a hypothetical threat to a very real and present threat. It can be these homeowners in New London, Connecticut today, and they lost big in the Supreme Court yesterday. It could be you, your church, your local organization, nonprofit, boys club, girls club. This is cutting pretty close to home. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Live from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the Supreme Court decision handed down yesterday in this case of New London, Connecticut, in which the court, by a 5-4 decision, gave to municipalities an increased power to use eminent domain in order to seize property. And this went right by a lot of people. But those who've been trying to build church facilities, those who are aware of the struggles faced in many communities, really had to recognize this was a very ominous development. And interestingly enough, this is one of those cases in which, when you go back to the press reports to when the oral arguments happened before the court, observers thought it was probably going to go the other way. You just don't know how the court's going to rule until you see the decision. Let's go to Rob, calling from Des Moines, Iowa, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Rob, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. This is totally outrageous, and it's just going to give another hammer to the government. Here in Des Moines, the district of our church has a campground, and the district wanted to make improvements on the campground and applied for the permits, and the city government would not allow those permits unless the district sold them or gave them some of the property. And now they've got, like I said, they've just got another hammer to beat us with.
Now, Rob, you know, there's a legal word that I think most of us would think of in hearing you tell this story, and I've heard of similar instances and examples of the very same thing, and that word would be extortion. I mean, isn't this the case in which the government said, or some government agency said, we want that property, we want to control it, so in order for you to have our permission just to enhance your buildings, you're going to have to give us some of that property. That's exactly what happened, right?
That's the word I used. I mean, it's obviously extortion. That's what it looks like to me, anyway.
You know, to think that the government now has increased power along these lines, I really do think this is something that should concern every American. But I'm afraid a lot of folks, a lot of citizens, won't be aware of this until it's their church, it's their fraternal organization, it's their neighborhood that is affected. Thanks so much for your call, Rob. We appreciate you filling us in on developments there in Des Moines. Let's go to Manheim, Pennsylvania, where Bill's also listening on XM Satellite Radio. Go right ahead, Bill.
Dr. Mohler, good to talk to you again. I'm 43. 25 years ago, when I was 18, I had an older gentleman in my small town where I live in Ohio, 70-some years old, an attorney, and he told me back then, Bill, I mean, he explained a lot of things to me, a good Christian man, but he said, Bill, watch out on how you buy properties. One day the government, this is what they're going to do. And what he explained to me then was exactly what happened yesterday. This gentleman told me that sometime early in the first part of the 1900s, when they went to the warranty deeds in Ohio, warranty deeds are nothing more than a contract with the state to allow you to stay on the property that you pay for. You pay that property off and you don't pay your property taxes, the government's going to take it.
Yeah, you know, Bill, there are all kinds of legal mechanisms that are involved with real estate that folks are often just unaware of until some kind of disaster strikes. I think not only is it the warranty deed issue and now the takings clause, it's also the issue of zoning. And if you look at some of the organizations that are trying to help Christian churches in these land issues, you'll notice how the zoning issue comes up again and again and again, because it is in the interest of communities, defined in terms of the tax base, for them to have as much of the property as possible held by those who are going to improve the property and then pay increased taxes on the property. Well, when you take nonprofit organizations and churches, they are exempt from paying property taxes, and there are just a lot of governments who are saying, look, we got bills to pay. So we don't want to allow a church to build on that property. We want to instead to have a commercial operation or a professional office building or a shopping mall or something like that where there will be taxes paid. And, of course, then they can turn that around and say, look, we're going to be generating jobs, generating revenues, economic opportunity. But, you know, what strikes me is that that is an argument that will never end. There's always something better that can be wherever anything is. You know, you could go to Manhattan where the Trump Tower now stands, kind of an example of the excesses recognized in the 1980s. Well, you know what? You could tear that down now and build something bigger right now that would conceivably pay more taxes. But we know that Donald Trump and the Trump Tower aren't in danger in this. Those in danger are those without a voice, those without political leverage, those without the kind of influence and impact to prevent this kind of thing from happening. Let's go to Phil calling from Seminole, Florida, listening on WTBN. Phil, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. My point is that I believe that this is the worst decision that the Supreme Court has made since Dred Scott. And the reason why I believe that is because it will polarize the American electorate like you have never seen before, and that you'll have some people that will go on the side of big business for development, and you will have others that will go on the side of big government. So you'll have a fascist-slash-communist mutated society, and I think it's going to absolutely, totally devastate our economy and our society as we know it.
Well, Phil, you're painting a darker picture even than most I've talked to here. I'm not sure about jumping to a communist fascist state here, although it is a reminder to us that any government will take as much power as conceded to it. I think we need to understand that. We as Christians have a doctrine of original sin that helps to explain that. We understand that the ambition of government to accrue power unto itself is something that that we've been warned about. That's why the founders of the United States, who were standing on the basis of a Christian worldview, understood that government must be limited and power must be dispersed precisely because we are sinners. And in this case, conceding this much power to the government, I think, is just extremely dangerous. Now, I'd also have to go back. Phil made an interesting argument about the worst case since Dred Scott. I'd have to put Roe v. Wade and now Lawrence v. Texas right up there on that list. But, you know, his comment is interesting because only in the perspective of history do we really know from some distance how dangerous a decision might really be. You have to look backwards sometimes and see that was what really laid the groundwork, the framework for disastrous consequences that would follow. You know, here's what I think. I think we're going to find some interesting shifting ground on this. I think you're going to find that there will be On other issues, those who are separated in terms of liberals and conservatives will be united on this. And I think an entirely different coalition may be supportive, celebrating what the Supreme Court ruled. You know, it is a reminder to us that that these rights having to do with land and property are about more than economics. Do we still believe there's something more powerful than the dollar? Do we still believe that there's something more important even than commerce? There's an emotional tie to land, and there's a purposive tie to land. And there is the need for those who will not produce tax revenues to have access to facilities and land in strategic areas, for churches to be able to demonstrate a Christian witness for the proclamation of the gospel. You have to weigh these things against freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and all the rest that is our inheritance as Americans. We'll be back to talk about why it's so in just a moment. I'm Albert Mueller. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller program. We're going to be watching this issue with you, and you know, it just may be that the light's going to go on in different places at different times based upon local developments. This was New London, Connecticut. Who's next? You know, I think what's going to happen is that there will be a lot of municipalities and local governments that are going to be emboldened by this decision to use the argument about economic development to take all kinds of acts against actions against landowners of various forms. And I think we're going to see this issue revisited. I'll be shocked if this issue does not return to the Supreme Court, because I think the court may here have violated the law of unintended consequences. It may have set the ground for a giant swell of opposition to and outrage to granting government this new power. And so it's happened before. It'll be interesting to see what happens next. Shifting gears for just a moment, I want to suggest a couple of important resources to you, and that's one of the things we try to watch on this program, just to let you know what's out there that you may find uniquely helpful. I want you to know of a new book entitled Sex and the Supremacy of Christ, edited by John Piper and Justin Taylor. It's just been released by Crossway Books. It comes complete with a DVD presentation of this conference by the same title, Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. It was held back in Minneapolis. I had the honor of being one of the plenary speakers at that conference. The chapters in this book are drawn from the presentations. The authors include John Piper, Ben Patterson, Dave Paulison, Mark Dever, C.J. Mahaney, and Carolyn Mahaney, Justin Taylor. Mark Dever, as I said, is involved in this, and so was I. I was speaking to the issue of same-sex marriage and how we as Christians should understand it. The framework of this book is how we should understand human sexuality over against a worldview that is centered in the supremacy of Christ. I think you'll find this book to be incredibly helpful, and I think you'll like the DVD, too, because this takes you right into the conference, and you can have the next best thing to having been there, and you can watch it over and over again. I mentioned that two of the contributors to this book are C.J. Mahaney and his wife, Carolyn Mahaney. I want you to know also that Carolyn Mahaney and her daughters, Nicole and Kristen and Janelle, are writing a blog. The blog is entitled Girl Talk, and at my weblog at albertmuller.com, I give you a link, and you can get right there. And it's interesting also that Carolyn and her daughter Nicole have written a book entitled Girl Talk, Mother-Daughter Conversations on Biblical Womanhood. These days, we need all the help we can get in making the correct biblical definitions and understandings about gender, appropriate roles from the Bible for men and women. This should be of great help to women, especially young women. It belongs in the hands of every woman trying to think through these issues. We'll be back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.